A Different Kind of Leader captures insights from diverse leaders in healthcare, public health, and academic settings so that our organizations are in a stronger position to grow, innovate, and meet the challenges of our day. To our listeners, thanks so much for joining us.
Welcome back to A Different Kind of Leader. We are thrilled to be joined by Dr. Monica Lipson. Dr. Lipson is the Vice Chair for Faculty Affairs and the Division Director for General Internal Medicine at the GW Medical Faculty Associates. Dr. Lipson provides visionary leadership for a diverse group of faculty involved in educational and patient care innovation, research, and community outreach. As Vice Chair, she is committed to creating and supporting the academic careers of all faculty members in the Department of Medicine. Monica, thanks so much for joining us today. I'm so excited to talk with you today.
It's my pleasure.
So, Monica, I'm going to start with the way we start every interview, which is a quote that embodies your leadership style, your approach to your career, or one that's been inspirational to you.
I'm going to give you two quotes. Keep on keeping on is a kind of familial quote. That's what I grew up with. It's what I think about when things are good, when things are bad. This was really a protest song by Lynn Chandler that came to fame in a speech by Martin Luther King. Curtis Mayfield recorded a song called Keep On Keeping On, and several different people. And that's sort of how I think about leadership in my personal journey. But when I think about sort of what I do every day for faculty, I think about every system is perfectly designed to get the results that it gets. And that really motivates me to think about things in a very systematic, thoughtful approach to problems and to situations. So the second quote that sort of drives me in my everyday job in the course of my work is every system is perfectly designed to get the results that it gets. Mm-hmm. And you can say that was either Paul Batalden, Arthur Jones, or Deming, but it's really a quality improvement paradigm that says instead of fighting the system, look at the system for what it's producing, and if you need to make a change, you know you need to look at the system to try to get a different outcome.
Those are two wonderful quotes. Can you share how you got into medicine? You've had so many leadership roles, particularly in medical education. Can you share how you got into medicine, how you made the choice around medical education? Maybe share a little bit about the research that you do and how you've really approached your leadership journey.
Fortunately or unfortunately, similar to many people in the late wave of affirmative action, I was really good at math and science as a kid. My parents were public school teachers. I was enrolled in a pipeline program that either routed people into medicine or routed people into engineering. I chose medicine. And then you have to ask why education. I was told explicitly by my educator parents that I couldn't be a teacher. And so everybody finds it actually quite funny that I ended up being in medical education. I guess it's destiny. It's the household I grew up in. And through that course of a journey, I have had the pleasure of creating networks. And my first real network was in a pipeline program on the south side of Chicago that was looking to get kids of color into careers either in engineering or science. And I had the pleasure of being in that program from the time I was in seventh grade all the way through medical school. And it really kept me grounded. When you ask, that's sort of how I got into medicine. Mm-hmm. I think by default and by being told that education wasn't an option, I don't think I ever thought that medical education was really an option until I got way down the line. And then when you ask about my journey into what do I do in terms of education, I think the best thing to ever spur me on is to tell me no. And I think when my parents told me that I couldn't be a teacher, I think part of my back of my head said, obviously that might be what I really want to do. So I'm going to figure out a way to do that. I can't say that that was way back in the consciousness, but I think it was really part of what drove me. And then, to be perfectly honest with you, the reason I decided about a career in education, in medical education, is because I was quite frustrated with the way I was being educated. I had the pleasure of going to Brown University. If you don't know, is an Ivy League school that basically is make your own curriculum for 4 years. I'm really learning how to learn. I have a great liberal arts background that I'm actually quite proud of. When I went to medical school, I was like, this to me, this is not the way to create thoughtful individuals. And so I walked into the vice dean's office as a first year medical student and basically told him his system sucked. And being the person that he was, David Stevens, who was the first journal editor of patient safety, being the smart guy that he did, said, great, Monica, I know exactly where I should put you. I'm going to put you on the curriculum committee.
Did you have any formal leadership training? We're in the midst now of a national crisis. And in the leadership role that you have now, I'm sure you're being called in a variety of places to exhibit that leadership that you've really exhibited throughout your career. Have you had any formal leadership training?
I try to take advantage of any opportunity that comes my way. And so I think I've sought out those opportunities throughout my career, be it as a student leader, being as a junior faculty. And I think some of the most transformational leadership training that I've had is the executive leadership in academic medicine program through Drexel for Women in Academic Medicine. I'm currently enrolled in the Aspen Health Innovators Fellowship Program through the Aspen Institute, and really taking advantage of various leadership programs throughout my career has really at least helped me anticipate the problems that are to come. I think that's what leadership training actually really does for you. I'm not sure it expands my toolbox a little bit, but it also helps prepare, well, what do you do in a crisis situation? I've actually had that tabletop exercise and various leadership training programs. So now that I'm in a crisis situation, I know that there's things in my toolkit that I can rely on.
What are the things that you're relying on? What are the things that you're pulling out? Earlier today, you had an opportunity to communicate. Did you pull out anything around crisis communication or other things?
Here's a perfect example. In various leadership training programs, I've had media training. In the last 3 years, have I talked to the media? No. In the last 2 weeks, have I had an opportunity to talk to the media? Yes. And one of the things that I remember from those crisis training programs is, remember, you need to think about what your talking points are. You need not be flabbergasted by what they want you to talk about. And I'll give you an example. This morning, when the producers called the university's marketing, there was one set of questions that I was expecting to answer around the current crisis, pandemic crisis, and I was totally prepared for that. I had my talking points. When I got on camera, the conversation went with what the hot topic was today, which is flatten the curve, and I had to pivot, and that's not what necessarily I had prepared for, but I actually also knew that I could use many of those talking points that I had prepared before to pivot to that question without getting flabbergasted, especially on camera representing my institution.
Being thoughtful about communication, being intentional about communication rather than reactive, I think is one of those skills that every leader needs to have and to practice, actually, and at every opportunity, being very intentional about the way that you convey not only the elements of the situation, but often in crisis communication, it's around comforting folks as well as clarity on sort of the way forward.
Right. I mean, and so it's been interesting to me. Have I done it perfectly in the last 2 weeks? No. Do I know I need to reach out to my faculty at least every other couple of days? Do I need to find some way to communicate? I think I've been pretty good about communicating with them, but I haven't probably been pretty good about simplifying that communication. And so I find myself sort of saying, okay, this is what you learned last week. What can you do differently this week? Okay, we're 3 days into this week. What are we going to learn for the next 2 days? So I think that that process improvement piece is really important, because you're right, when people feel like they have no control, you have to give them something to reach for.
So, Monica, going back to your second quote about systems creating the outcomes that we see, and in the context of your role as a leader around faculty development now at your institution, all of the leadership roles you've held at the AAMC through the Veterans Affairs around medical education, what do you see, or what are your thoughts around diversity in leadership and the sort of lack of diverse leaders that we see in healthcare, the lack of the number, I should say, of diverse leaders we see in healthcare, in our health systems, in our academic settings? What are your thoughts about that? How can we create a system that would enhance diversity?
My answer is the reason we don't see the numbers, I guess if we wanted to look at that as a outcome, is that the system is perfectly designed to create the results that it gets. So the system was not created to create and think about a diverse set of leaders. So I think your question is right on target about sort of, if you want to fix it, you actually have to look at systematic approaches as opposed to trying to change people. A lot of our efforts have always been around, we just want people. What we often forget is that we have to actually change the structural systems to actually reflect what we need. You've asked about leadership, but I would say that the pipeline into medicine is lacking its diversity, so that if you really want to think about the end of that pipeline, which might be leaders, you might want to start to say, okay, what do I need to do about that entire plumbing system? So one is, because I have small children, I think a lot about K through 12 education. So if you are having systems that don't create children who are algebra ready by high school, you are naturally not going to create systems that create doctors at the end. So we can actually go back that far. So you say, okay, I don't do K through 12 education, Monica. And I'd say, well, actually, that's where you really want to think about your pipeline. That's fine. I think there's plenty of people at the undergraduate and medical school level. We have a diverse set of pre-meds and medical students. And you say, okay, why aren't they progressing on in terms of GME and in terms of faculty roles? Maybe your system is not looking at the characteristics of what I might want to look for in your leader. I think there's been some great work looking about who is eligible for AOA. So that's the Alpha Omega Alpha, which is the Phi Beta Kappa for medical school, medical education. And there's been some great studies in the last couple of years looking at the lack of diversity for that. So if you're looking to create a prestigious residency program and one of your criteria is AOA, if the AOA candidates aren't diverse, your residency program is necessarily not going to have a diverse system. So you could actually go back to schools and say, hey, maybe you need to think differently about your AOA criteria. You could go to residency programs and say, hey, maybe that's not the only metric that you should be thinking about when you want to think about who would make a good doctor at the end of training. Those would be the ways that you can make systematic approaches besides the appealing to people's moral values that diversity is important.
That's fantastic. And so what about in the realm of faculty? As we, in terms of your faculty development programs, are there things in particular that you're thinking, you're been in this role for about a little under a year, I would say, or even under 6 months now that I'm thinking about it. So maybe you haven't made systematic changes yet at GW. I know you have.
We think about why aren't our faculty progressing on the academic ladder? We aren't seeing people move from assistant professor to associate professor to professor. And people go, oh, I don't know, there's something wrong with the faculty. When you actually start to talk to the faculty, it's because you haven't created an environment that makes that explicit as an expectation, and you haven't created an environment that gives people the mentorship and care and feeding that they need. So one of the things we're looking at is how can we utilize peer mentorship? How can we utilize all of the resources on campus to help with the medical school, which often feels isolated and different? And one of the great things about thinking about sort of academic trajectory is I actually can rely on many of the expertise I learned in diverse and sort of minority faculty development and bringing those skill sets to say, hey, it's not that there's something special that we need to do in terms of thinking about our minority faculty. Maybe there's something that we need to do for all faculty, and that, yes, our diverse faculty have special needs, but actually maybe we need to think that everybody needs to have a platform from which they can strive to be the best that they can.
One of the things that I noticed on my promotion and tenure committees is that oftentimes faculty will come with as glowing a pedigree in terms of schooling, higher education, training. And it's always was remarkable to me the stance that some chairs would take that somehow these individuals who've been able to accomplish so much, who come from backgrounds that might be otherwise disadvantaged, that somehow in the academic environment or in the faculty environment that they were could not be successful. We all had and have the intelligence, educational attainment, and pedigree to get to this point. And so I always started to wonder about the policies and practices and whether there were actually clear policies about advancement. What I've found is that once it's clear, once you have the rules laid out, just like medical school, people are able to do it. It's when it's that hidden curriculum, right, where there's not that clarity that it seems to benefit one group versus another. And I just wondered about how that was, if that any of that was part of your faculty development approach.
So it's clear that many of us who come from diverse backgrounds have been educationally successful. I don't think anybody would doubt my pedigree or your pedigree. In fact, our pedigree looks like many of our peers. I think the question often comes about how do you actually transcend and make promotion? And I think you're right. One of the things is understand what the rules are. There are formal rules and there are informal rules. And one of the things that a system can do is actually make very explicit the formal rules. And usually, you're right, when the formal rules become explicit, your colleagues compete on even standard across the board. Looking at the research from the NIH, when looked at Black faculty members who were competing for grants, when you actually looked at the number of publications, they were actually had as many, if not more, than their white colleagues. And now you have to ask the second question, okay, what's the hidden rule or the implicit rule? I think really has to do with networks, that there are a set of implicit rules that often people who have been minoritized all of their life are not privy to. Or there are a list of rules and ways of being that come naturally to others because of their upbringing, where other people have to learn that. And I think that's where we need to understand what system is at work in regards to those things that might hamper promotion on what people might argue is a meritocracy, when we know, in fact, there's other things at play.
Fantastic. Thank you. Monica, you've held a number, as I've mentioned, leadership roles, national leadership roles. What are the things that you weigh when you're looking at these leadership opportunities? And are there any red flags that you try to avoid?
So the red flag that I try to avoid is actually people thinking they know better than I do about what I should do. You can actually get caught up quite a bit into what other people say and what other people think. And I think one of my advantages has been a common thing that people will look at me and say over the course of my junior and mid-career is, Monica, you really don't have a focus. You do a little bit of diversity stuff. You do a lot of education stuff. You do some clinical administration stuff. Why don't you have a clear focus? I'm really interested in a bunch of different things. I'm a generalist at heart. I want to explore these things, and I actually think there's pieces of these that enhance my leadership skill set. So it never felt unfocused to me, but the damage that you can do is to really think about that from other people's perspective. And I think the advantage has been that when one door closes for me, because I have a full skill set, I could actually pivot and move quite easily. I think the question, if you want to look at it a different way, about what do I weigh in terms of pros and cons about service at the national level, one of the things that guides me is that often you're not a prophet in your own land. And so doing a lot of national things has actually given me the influence that I need often in my local environment. So when somebody says to my dean, my chair, et cetera, oh, I heard Monica say that, it looks very different than me saying, which I might have said the same thing in a meeting yesterday. They hear it very differently. And so I have found that to be an advantage. And I tell a lot of my juniors and peers that that actually is an important advantage. That's why you want to expand your network from that particular stance. And I think the thing that I'm most sensitive now is I'm not really interested in being your token whatever. I can hit several different check boxes, and I am sensitive to try to figure out if I'm there to meet one of your interests. But I have to say, sometimes even when I know I'm there to meet an interest, you know, to make sure that you have a Black woman or a mother or a something, it's not that I've necessarily said no either. It's just that I've gone into that situation with my eyes wide open.
Can you say more about building that network? That was part of your first quote in terms of building community. It was part of this idea around sort of systematic change. And it's, again, part of the sort of the way you've thought about leadership and your leadership opportunities and how you've leveraged your national standing in your work. So can you say a little bit more about the ways that you've gone about, either intentional or even in hindsight, building your network nationally?
That actually probably is that's my superpower.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
You know, sometimes you have to be honest about what you're good. I'm a node. If you think about network analysis, mm-hmm. I'm a classic node. And I've been a node all of my life. I've been a node in middle school. I've been a node in high school. And in those situations, being a node felt very awkward. So I'm someone who could hang out with the Black kids who sit together in the cafeteria in high school, but I also could hang out with the nerds in pre-calculus and have a meaningful conversation there and bring those two worlds together when it was necessary and needed. I think I apply those same things to my day-to-day work. And so my advantage is really trying to understand, maybe there's something about hanging out with a bunch of venture capitalists that I need to understand about where the future of healthcare is going. I'm signing up to understand how community leaders work in Ward 7 and 8 in Washington, D.C., because I need to understand the impact of gentrification and poverty and the social determinants of health. Being able to understand how both those networks work, where the overlaps are, has been my secret sauce. I have to say, I think that was a natural talent that I had, but I've actually developed and cultivated it over time.
Definitely, that is your secret superpower. Maybe not so secret anymore. What are your sources of inspiration?
I try to find them everywhere. And I have to say, most of them are actually pretty local. My husband shows me every day about how I could be a better doctor. He runs a sickle cell program, and when his patients call and his dedication to sort of just patient care and thinking about the next level of research that's needed to care from a special population, I'm like, wow, I don't think about medicine in that way, and I need to be inspired. When I think about community partnerships, you know, I have a cousin, Crystal Crockett, who's actually fundraising in Chicago to build a women's center housing. Like, this is just my cousin. She retired as a public school teacher, and she's like, hey, I think I want to buy a house where women can go for transitional housing. I'm like, okay. Wow. But you know, I'm like, okay, that's fascinating. Wow. Right, that's right. I mean, and that's just on the cousin listserv. But then if I think nationally, I've been thinking a lot about Anita Hill lately and this idea of how hurt and how embarrassing and how life-changing things looked like 20 years ago, and then to see how you can take lemons and make them into lemonade, to me, is pretty profound. Hani Stolka, who's an emergency medicine doc at the Brigham, who's been worked on human trafficking. You know, I'm in awe of people who have found that connection with the people most in need and found a way to get the system to change and to help them. So I try to find inspiration every day in everything that I do. I guess I don't have any special heroes, but there are people I think about all the time.
I love that. Yeah. And talk about Anita Hill, just what talk about leadership under fire. Incredible courage. What's your favorite leadership book or a book that you would recommend to others?
So I really like Getting to Yes. I go into every conversation thinking about what my BATNA is.
Mm-hmm.
What's my best alternative to a negotiated
agreement, right.
but I think, especially for minority faculty, that sometimes you have to know where you are and where you're going to walk away, where you can leave with your dignity. Because I think sometimes that's all you're going to leave with. I will walk into most conversations. I was just upstairs, and I was like, okay, what's my BATNA in this situation? And it's not because I'm prepared for some high-power meeting. It's just sort of, you know, what are my clear talking points, and what do I want to accomplish?
Yeah, and it also goes back to values and priorities. The way I think about the BATNA is, like, what line will I not cross? What are you reading or listening to now?
I just finished Gladwell's book, When Strangers Talk.
Yeah, that's on my list.
It took me a long time to get through it.
Really? His books are usually quick reads.
Oh, it is.
there was like a national crisis going on, so maybe that's why.
No. It was uncomfortable. He was telling you everything you already knew. One of the things I have spent a lot of time with in teaching is around communication skills. For medical students and faculty in terms of dealing with patients. And basically his book is all about, you don't really know what's on the other side of that exam table. You don't know what's really on the other side of how people think and how you approach a stranger really has large societal implications. And so I had to start and stop that book because he uses the narrative of Sandra Bland throughout. It was pretty profound emotionally. It took a lot to kind of get through.
I'm reading The New Jim Crow. Finally got the
card. Oh, that, yes. Yeah, I can't even, yeah. That, it is interesting for me about, in some ways, having to create some distance. I can work on that in my work setting. I can talk about discrimination, racism, disparities. But in my private life, like, I want to go home and I need a little space to sort of decompress.
Yeah, I think that's what, as a mother of three Black males and married to a Black male, the New Jim Crow sat on my bedside table for obviously for years before I could pick it up, given sort of the personal connection there that's there for me. What do you think separates good leaders from great leaders?
I've been trying to work on leaning into the discomfort. And so I think the great leaders lean into the discomfort and not shy away from that, and admit when it's really hard, but really try to create a vision of what's possible. So I think that's what's there. I think that's, it's the emotional part that you don't get in leadership training, how to handle the emotional consequences of decisions and actions. I wish there was more time spent there. That's what I use. So you're part of my sort of intimate network, peer friends, where I can take those emotions of, I'm really jealous that Giselle just got this job. What do I do with this jealousy? So whenever I feel jealous, I actually reach out to the person and congratulate them for whatever, because I know if I do the action, the very action I think I don't want to do, the feeling will follow.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, that's so insightful, Monica. I mean, there's so many ways to lean into that discomfort, but that's intensely personal. The discomfort as in terms of who is the person that I feel that I want to be. It's really about that vulnerability and the willingness to sort of look closely at who do I say I want to be, and how is this feeling that I have in conflict with that person, and identifying that as a moment of growth for yourself. That's deep. What advice would you give to your younger self?
Smell the roses. It is the journey. I mean, it really is the journey. I come from a people that have made that clear. But of course, when you're living it, it's really hard to, it's hard to feel it. And so just sort of slow down and say it's okay. You know, if I had to do it differently, you know, would I have taken some time off? Would I have explored some different things? Yes, but do I regret what I've done? No, it's just Monica, relax.
Monica, thanks so much for being with us today. It was really wonderful to get a chance to talk with you.
Well, thank you. This podcast is absolutely terrific to be able to listen to Bingay talk about You See My Glory and Not My Story has been outstanding. I look forward to hearing more from you in the differing leadership path.
Take care of yourself. Good luck out there.
Thank you.
You have been listening to A Different Kind of Leader. If you like what you have heard, please rate us and leave a comment wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps others find us. Also, look for us on Facebook and Instagram at Different Kind of Leader, as well as Twitter at DK Leadership. You can also email us at differentkindofleader@gmail.com. Please let us know what leadership questions you have for guests and which inspiring leaders you would like for us to interview next.